Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I appreciate you joining me as we continue to go through the big monster box of baseball cards from the 80s and early 90s. And I've got some good news for you. We're almost done with 1992. We've been pouring through the 1992 sets quite literally since the beginning of the month. And our podcast comes to you twice weekly, Tuesdays and Fridays, via Audioboom and iTunes. And I remember the first 1992 set we started right after the new year. And we've been stuck in 1992 ever since the calendar flipped to 2017. But we only have three more sets, at least from this monster box. We've got Stadium Club and then the Topps base set. We'll cover those next week. But we've got the one brand that everybody was trying to catch up to, and most companies did. A few of them actually exceeded this brand in 1992 in terms of quality and hobby appreciation. And that, of course, would be Upper Deck as they released their 92 set to very little fanfare. And if I recall correctly, this would be the year that the torch was kind of passed. It started getting passed back and forth. You know, Upper Deck had carried it for so long, ever since they started in 1989. But by 1992, I think Stadium Club, I think Fleer Ultra had moved ahead, and then Upper Deck by 93 would have to make some changes to try to keep up with the pace. Still a very nice set. We'll look at it detail by detail in just a little bit, as well as the career of Frank Thomas. Yes, the Big Hurt.
You can put it on the board. Yes.
That's the best Ken Harrelson I'll give you. That's the only Ken Harrelson I'll give you. You can thank me later. Card number 166 of the 92 Upper Deck set. A beauty of a card, as you always expected from Upper Deck. But again, it was more of the same. So we'll go through that in just a little bit. First, a little bit of housekeeping. Pretty quiet week on our Twitter feed, Wax and Gum Stains, and that's okay. Every now and then we've got a lot of talk. Like last week we had a lot of talk, and then it kind of dies down for a few days and then goes back up. So not going to go through all of the comments that we had, but we had quite a bit of hobby talk, not necessarily on a podcast or a player that we have done or just the show in general, but a lot of hobby talk going on. And I always encourage that. So if you have a Twitter account and you want to follow us on Twitter, you can do so at Wax and Gum Stains. You can comment about our podcast. You can comment about any of the players that we talk about, any of the sets that we talk about, or if you just want to talk about the hobby, whatever is on your mind, be it new cards or old cards, you know, whatever we're talking about, you're more than welcome to chime into the conversation at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. As I mentioned, Wax Ecstatic comes your way on Tuesdays and Fridays via Audio Boom and iTunes. And just a reminder, we're still looking for a title sponsor to the show. We're looking for somebody that has a product or service that we can link up with our listeners and vice versa. And it's a low price point. And for our listeners, I just want to tell you, I'm not going to clobber you with advertisements over and over again. We're going to try to strike that right balance to where we introduce you to that product or service. Our listeners are welcome to try it. And for that product or service that wants to invest, it's a pretty low price point to get involved. It is a growing audience here on Wax Ecstatic. We've grown by leaps and bounds over the last couple of months in particular. And I thank you, the listener, for being part of that. And, you know, without you, this whole podcast wouldn't be possible. Actually, it would be possible, except I would be talking to myself. And I do enough of that during my time. So I appreciate having other voices hear the voices inside my head. It's very relaxing and refreshing to have that little change in your life. But as for sponsorship, again, if you're interested or you know somebody who would be interested, just send me a direct message at Wax and Gum Stains. I follow pretty much everybody, most everybody who follows us. And you could just send a direct message and we could try to get a deal done. All right, Frank Thomas, the Big Hurt, also another nickname. A little mocking nickname. I'll share that story in a few minutes. But let's talk a little bit about 92 Upper Deck, because this does warrant a little extra time. As we look back at a set that was actually a very good set, a very popular set back in 1992, of course, 25 years later, much like most every other set from 1992. There's still a ton of it out there, and you can buy wax boxes or foil boxes, if you want to call it that, or complete factory sets for a relatively low price these days. But the 92 Upper Deck set, as opposed to some other card sets from around that time that have gotten just forgotten, just kind of pushed to the back burner, 92 Upper Deck is still well-liked, well-known, but Upper Deck clearly had lost a little bit of its step, in my opinion, in 1992. Now, that's not to say it's a bad set. Like I said, I actually really like this set. But the company that just totally turned the hobby on its ear in 1989 and will continue to do so in 1990 and 91, well, guess what? By 92, everybody else had caught up. And you know how the saying goes, and especially if you work in any kind of technology field, or, you know, in my case, broadcasting, it doesn't matter if you're first, if you're not doing it the best. And there's always a lot of fanfare for the first this to come around. But you have to constantly reinvent yourself. You have to grow. You have to add. You have to subtract. You have to be just a little different, or else you get passed by. And it's funny how, especially when you're dealing with a consumer industry, it's funny how fickle consumers can be. And I think one great example of that right now is actually the Apple Corporation. 10 years ago, the iPhone came out and it was revolutionary. You know, the iPhone was to mobile phones almost what Upper Deck was to the hobby. In fact, you can see a lot of parallels here. It's very scary. To where, and I've said this before, the hobby, everybody eventually went from being their own brand, and I've likened it to the General Motors lineup of cars, where Cadillac was the top brand, and then beneath that you had Buick, and beneath that you had Pontiac, and beneath that you had Chevrolet. And you could slot in, you know, obviously General Motors had three or four other brands that you could slot in there. But, you know, tops you could call the Chevrolet. Fleer, you could call the Buick. You could try to liken them to a different brand. Well, by 1992, because Upper Deck had done so well, everybody tried to be Cadillac. Well, much like the card industry in the late 80s and early 90s with everybody trying to be Cadillac, after iPhone came out in 2007, well, over the next 2, 3, 4 years, everybody tried to be like the iPhone. So now when a new iPhone rolls out, instead of people going, it's like a vision from heaven coming down. You know, Moses holds up the iPhone tablets. Well, they're large enough now to be tablets to write down the Ten Commandments. But you catch my drift. You know, there used to be this great big presentation. Of course, you had the late Steve Jobs doing it. Well, now you roll out the iPhone and people just kind of go, I don't like this or this. You know, people actually pick apart at it. And now Apple is, you know, trying to reinvent themselves. It's less the hardware. Well, now they're working on new TV programs and streaming initiatives and stuff like that. So even Apple has to reinvent itself every few years. Well, to bring this full circle, Upper Deck, while they were the first, and for a few years, they were absolutely bar none the best, by 1992, they started getting passed by. And in my opinion, the sets that really started passing by Upper Deck were Stadium Club by far, because Stadium Club really fired the first shot across the bow in 1991. Now, of course, related to Stadium Club, Bowman, which was owned by the Topps brand, Bowman with a much better product in 1992. Fleer Ultra, with a much better product in 1992. You know, the Fleer base set was an improvement, but Ultra was just incredible. So Upper Deck rolls out their product, and even though it's a nice set and it's a good-looking set, there was nothing to really bring you the wow factor that you had in 89. And that was just by design, and I mean that by like an artistic design. That was also with just the design of the set itself. And some of the other bells and whistles that hobbyists were looking for in 1992, for the first time in its existence, Upper Deck didn't lead the way. And what I mean by that is, first of all, the design. So let's take a look at the Upper Deck card here. Frank Thomas, card number 166. Now, again, it's a sharp card. This is a great picture. This is the smile of Frank Thomas that we all know and love, even if you were never a White Sox fan. this is, if there was ever one picture to sum up Frank Thomas, this is it. Very much like Ken Griffey Jr., card number one from 89 Upper Deck. So you've got this great shot, crystal clear, the brand new White Sox uniform. And in many ways, the White Sox were way ahead of the whole retro look, because the Sox basically had this uniform in the late 1950s and early 1960s. They brought it back at the tail end. I remember it was like the last week of the 1990 season, wore it in 91, and it just was off like gangbusters. A lot of people bought it. And of course, this was back in the days when black and silver were very popular colors for sports uniforms, but also gang colors in certain situations. But here's Thomas, great picture of him in his batting pose. And you have the Upper Deck logo in the upper left-hand corner. You have the player's name in the upper right-hand corner. And in the lower right-hand corner, what I think was neat was instead of the usual use of a Major League Baseball logo, and I've said 1,000 times before on this podcast, I'm a huge fan of baseball logos. Put them on there, please. I love it. Well, Upper Deck in 92 decided to not just use the usual primary logo, they used the secondary logo. So in the case of the Chicago White Sox, it's not the interlocking SOX like you see on Thomas's hat here, but it was basically the script logo. And that's what the White Sox had as a secondary logo at that time. Now, eventually that would change to the black diamond with the white sock, which was their primary logo back in the 1950s. But in 1992, this was their secondary logo. And if you look through the 1992 Upper Deck set, you see that. And I think that's a very neat way of changing things up just a little bit. And when you look at the front of this card too, one thing that really stands out is the photograph is kind of levitating. You know, there's a shadow box effect on the right side and at the bottom of the picture to make it look like it's 3D. I mean, it doesn't come off as 3D, but it looks like it's levitating a little bit. So just kind of floating out there. And that is kind of neat. But this is where the design starts having its limitations. While it's neat and very good looking and crisp and clear and simple, by 92, and this all started with Stadium Club back in 91, by 92, the direction was borderless pictures, or borderless cards, I should say, you know, to where the front of the card, you didn't have the white space around it or whatever color. Well, here you've got a lot of border on the card. So this is something that Upper Deck was doing as early as 1989, and they were continuing to do it. Well, here it is in 1992 when, again, hobbyists are clamoring for something a little different, cleaner, not really a design change, but just eliminate the borders and just give me a whole lot of picture. So Upper Deck kind of does that, but they don't do it because, again, you have this very clean, simple design with the picture kind of floating there, but you got a whole lot of white space all around the edges here. And I liken this to the person that says, I'm giving up chocolate for Lent, or, you know, the new year, or, you know, whatever time period. That's it. I'm changing. I'm giving up chocolate. Except for M&Ms. That's what Upper Deck's doing here. They're going, we're going to completely redesign this and give it a nice modern feel. Except for that white border we've had since 1989. That's basically what they did. So, again, while the overall look is nice, by how much the hobby had changed in 1992, Upper Deck is coming up short here. And again, this would be the first time where Upper Deck was trailing the trend, trailing the competition with a lot of aspects of their card. Now, let's flip the card over. You look at the back of the card here. Again, card number 166. What do you see? If you didn't look at the year listed in the stats box on the left side of this card, and that's if you're holding the card vertically. Of course, this card was also designed to where if you laid it down horizontally, it'd be a lot easier on your neck. You're not craning looking at it. But if you didn't look at the year that was listed on this card, you could very easily say that this was a 91 Upper Deck, or it was a 90 Upper Deck or even 89. Now, the back of the 89 upper deck was a little more distinguished, but it would be very easy to just look at this and be totally confused as to which year this came out. If you looked at the back first, and again, you weren't looking at the year that was listed on the card. So that was another thing with the upper deck back in the entire set in 1992. It had not innovated basically from what happened in 1989. You had the player's name and position and the card number all at the top. You had his stats right beneath it. You had, in the case of Frank Thomas, you had a little bit of room to, put some little notes here, talking about his first full season, how he led in a lot of the statistical departments. And then you had the big color photograph. So again, it's nice. It's what you've come to know and love from Upper Deck. But in a changing hobby, it was nothing new. Really, the only difference from this card and any other card that Upper Deck produced that year was the foil stamp, which you can't really see. It's kind of flashed out here when I took this picture. But the foil stamp, which is beneath the card number there, and it's in that baseball diamond shape, the pack cards, or the singles, if you will, they had the silver foil stamp, while the complete factory set, you had the gold foil stamp. So this was an attempt by Upper Deck for a number of reasons. First of all, you couldn't have a dealer, say, break open a set, put a card, a star card, or a big rookie card in a top load, or put it on a display case and say, oh, I just pulled this out of a pack. That would try to counteract that. But also the other way around, you couldn't have somebody put together a hand collated set, put it in a box that looked like a factory set, and then sell it as a factory set. So in many ways, this was kind of a, not really a counterfeiting move, but you know what I mean? Just trying to limit the people who were trying to sell something secondhand as if it were factory made. So that was really the only big difference. So a neat little change there for security, but again, the general design of the card, it looks nice. It's a pretty card, but it was very much what you saw in 1991 and 1990 and 1989 along with that. And, again, really only other clue that you could see that this was slightly different than other sets is, and you could see this in between the MLB logo and the MLBPA logo, you've got this 1992 baseball logo that Upper Deck added to the base of the card. Again, if you're holding it up vertically. So it's a nice card, but it was not all that different from what Upper Deck had put out before. And it wasn't just the design that was pretty much more of the same. It was how Upper Deck put the set together. You had the standard low set, or low number, high number set. While other card sets were going into two series, Upper Deck had always had the 1 through 700 low number set, 701 to 800 high number set. Well, they did the exact same thing in 1992. They would change it up in 1993. And you also had a lot of the same inserts. You had, the foil cards, the hologram cards and hologram stickers. And you also had a chase for autograph cards. In 1992, Ted Williams was the Hall of Fame insert. So you had a series of 9 cards that documented some of the highlights of Ted Williams' career. And then you had 2,500 cards that were autographed by Williams. And then in the high series, you had 2,500 autographed cards and, Upper Deck Heroes cards, the playing cards without the autographs, of both Joe Morgan and Johnny Bench. Of course, Morgan had just, I think, a couple years before been inducted into the Hall of Fame. Bench a couple years before them. So, you had a couple of the, big cogs of the big red machine. So there was a little bit of a wow factor with that. But again, you saw that in 1991. You saw that in 1990. You had your Hank Aarons and your Reggie Jacksons. It was good, but the hobby was changing. It was nothing new. It was nothing innovative. So that is something that really kind of bogs down this set. Even though it was a quality set, there were some great photography, some good rookie cards, some good star cards, and the quality that you would expect from Upper Deck, the innovation that you would hope for, because this was their fourth set. You would think they would change things up just a little bit by now because everybody else did. Upper Deck wasn't able to do that. So they kind of took a step back, a very small one, but they kind of took a step back in 1992, which they would then have to make up for in 1993. Now, as I mentioned, because this is a set from 1992, despite some of the star power in here, including a young slugger like Frank Thomas, the cards are plentiful these days and very easy to get your hands on. In fact, there's only a couple of cards that are of any noteworthy value. There's a Manny Ramirez top prospect card. You can get a few dollars for it. You know, the Frank Thomas card, ungraded. Maybe you sell it for a buck, something like that. But really not too many cards where, you know, there's a big dollar amount to it. Foil packs or the boxes, I should say, you can still buy factory sealed boxes for $10 to $15, depending on where you buy them from. And factory sealed sets you can get for $15 to $20. And that kind of shows you, too, how far down the ladder Upper Deck had gotten to by 1992. First of all, because they were printing a gazillion cards like everybody else was at the time, but also because there was really nothing that stood out about the 92 set compared to some of its predecessors. Hobbyists didn't necessarily gobble it up like they did with Stadium Club or Fleer Ultra or Bowman. And of course, Bowman actually went out of their way to reduce the amount of cards that were actually made. So there was some literal value that you could hang on to that. So there's plenty of Upper Deck cards out there from 1992. They won't cost you an arm and a leg. And even though I'm panning this set for not having too much originality in 92, it is still a very nice set. You're going to get the stars. You're going to get the rookies. You're going to get the great photography. You've got the tamper-proof packaging. You've got the foil stamps, which hopefully if you buy these days are not peeling off the cards. That's still one of the downsides to the foil sticking around on the back of a piece of cardboard for 25 plus years. But despite that minor little problem there, you still get a very nice set here. So, again, you don't want to think you're going to make a mint off of these cards, but this is one of those situations where if you have $20, $25, $30, go ahead and buy yourself a couple of boxes. Get the jumbo packs for the upper number series, the high number series, and see what you can put together, because it will be a nice set when you pull it all together. And because Upper Deck, even though they slipped a little bit in 92, because it's Upper Deck, even the common cards are worth a little more than a common card from any other set that year. You know, you could see common cards listed for 20, 25 cents. Not that you're actually going to get that trying to sell them. But, you know, you could see some common cards for anywhere from 10 cents to 25 cents, where a set like Score, I mean, a common card's a penny. So, you know, there's really a little more value in the Upper Deck collection as a whole. But again, being 800 cards from top to bottom, well, that's a lot of cards. It's still a pretty massive set from that year. Not as massive as Frank Thomas, though. 6'5", 240 pounds, a kid who was an absolute star at Columbus High School in his native town of Columbus, Georgia. And you would think some of the numbers and some of the things he did for a state championship team in the late 1980s would get him drafted, gobbled up by a major league team, and on the way he goes into professional baseball stardom, making the Baseball Hall of Fame. Well, no. In fact, Frank Thomas was eligible for the 1986 draft, and despite all of the wonderful things that he did as a youth in Columbus, Georgia, he was completely bypassed, which now when you look back at it, it is mind-boggling. How did everybody miss on this guy? So he gets completely bypassed, very similar to the random pull from our last podcast on 92 Score, Jim Tomei. But Tomei, he only went to college for 1 year before the Indians grabbed him in the draft. Well, Frank Thomas decided to take that short end of the stick situation and put it to good use by going to Auburn University. And I will forgive him for that. I'm an Alabama grad. So still, Auburn really hit the jackpot with this guy, because Frank Thomas was not only an outstanding baseball player, but He was also an outstanding football player. In fact, he was an all-state tight end in football, played basketball as well. In the day and age of the multi-sport star, Bo Jackson, Deion Sanders, Brian Jordan, you name it, you really could have had one here in Frank Thomas. But what happened was he went to Auburn on a football scholarship, was dealing with some injuries, went to the baseball field, and all of a sudden the head coach of the Auburn baseball team, Hal Baird, a legendary coach at Auburn, by the way, still has the most wins in program history. Well, Hal Baird sees this guy hitting, on their diamond, and I've actually seen this in an interview. He turns to one of his assistant coaches and says, well, I'm not sure, you know, what he's going to do here for the tenure of his time with us, but let's just make sure he arrives to the ballpark on time. You know, a rather nice way of saying, don't lose sight of this kid. We're going to use him. So Hal Baird had the incredibly good fortune of first having Bo Jackson and then having Frank Thomas fall into his lap. So even though Thomas went to Auburn on a football scholarship, he gradually shifts over to baseball full time, very similar to Reggie Jackson, what he did at Arizona State in the mid-60s. So here's Frank Thomas. He goes to Auburn, and he's just clobbering the ball out of the park there. He had a chance to play for the U.S. Olympic team in 1988, somehow got cut from that. So again, you're wondering, how does this happen? But Thomas perseveres. He gets drafted by the Chicago White Sox in the 1989 draft, and it pays off for him, not getting drafted in 86. It turns out all of his time at Auburn does not go to waste, as he is drafted in the first round. So that certainly helps not only his contracts then, but moving forward. And he makes a very quick rise to the big leagues, makes his debut August 2nd, 1990. And for a rather crappy White Sox team, he plays out the final couple of months here, plays 60 games, hits .330, 7 home runs, 31 RBI, has an OPS of .983. So we've talked about some of the players who have been random pulls for us where we go, yeah, you know, they didn't really show much, in their first few games or first year in the big leagues. Well, Frank Thomas is the opposite. You knew very early on this guy was going to be a stud, and he certainly showed it in 1991, playing 158 games for the White Sox, .318 batting average, 32 home runs, 109 RBI. He had an on-base percentage of .453, an OPS of 1.006, and he led the league in walks. He was such a feared hitter at the age of 23, he led the American League in walks with 138. So in his sophomore season, Frank Thomas finishes third in the American League MVP voting. He wins a Silver Slugger Award as well. Wasn't eligible for the Rookie of the Year Award because he had over 130 at-bats in 1990. He had 191 officially. So that's why Chuck Knobloch gets the Rookie of the Year Award. Frank Thomas didn't, in case you were wondering. And this wasn't a flash in the pan situation. This was the beginning of a great career. Amazingly, Thomas wouldn't be named to the All-Star team until 1993, but deservedly so. He hit .317, 41 home runs, 128 RBI, and he was not only an All-Star and a Silver Slugger that year, he was the American League MVP. And then in the strike-shortened 1994 season, another player you could say coulda, shoulda, woulda with the strike, in 113 games, Frank Thomas had 38 home runs. So if you extrapolate that, he could have been very, very close to 61 home runs had the 94 season been completed and had he stayed healthy. And of course, this was early in his career. He was still a very healthy player here. So despite the season being shortened, he still hit .353, had 38 home runs, 101 RBI, an OPS of 1.217. Still, despite the shortened season, led the American League in walks with 109. He was the MVP once again, an All-Star and a Silver Slugger once again. And his All-Star time in Chicago would continue. He was named an All-Star three more times the next three seasons, to be exact. He also finished third in the MVP voting in 1997 when he led the American League in batting with a .347 average and 35 home runs, a 1.067 OPS. And he continued a very successful run in Chicago throughout the 1990s. And I should add, in 2000 was the runner-up American League MVP vote-getter with a .328 batting average, 43 home runs, and 143 RBI. Then the downturn happens, 2001. He has a major injury to his arm. I believe his biceps were torn, and he had a very short season. He only appeared in 20 games in 2001. Bounces back nicely in 2002 and 2003, but his batting average plunges. Here's a guy who was averaging .330 in his first, 8-9 seasons in the American League. Well, now it's in the mid-250s and 260s. He's still knocking the ball out of the park. He's still getting walked. He's still striking out a fair bit, but he's starting to get limited in his ability to play. And he was primarily a designated hitter by this point in time. You know, he did start out, in case you didn't know, he did start out as a first baseman, but by the time the 98 season rolled around, he was actually pretty much the White Sox designated hitter. So, you know, this is a guy who is pretty much depending totally on his bat, and it's starting to fail him a little bit here, and his body is starting to fail him as well. Appears in only 74 games in 2004. 34 games in 2005, was not on the postseason roster for the White Sox, so he did not play in the World Series, which the White Sox won, their first since 1917. But he's still honored by the team. They give him a World Series ring. He's part of the World Series parade. He threw out the first pitch of the World Series in Game 1. So he was still very much part of the organization. But then the messy breakup happens. It's one of those he said, she said situations. Thomas said that, you know, he never heard from Jerry Reinsdorf or Kenny Williams, you know, when they decided to cut ties with him. And, of course, the team maybe followed through with that, and they didn't contact him. So even though it made total sense that the White Sox would sever ties with a 37-year-old Frank Thomas, who was injury-plagued at this point in time, still contributing, but certainly nowhere near the level that he could have, like he had, you know, 8-10 years before. So it's a really messy divorce between the White Sox and Frank Thomas. So he goes out, signs an incentive-laden contract with the Oakland A's, and is the comeback player of the year in 2006. In fact, he got the fourth most votes for the American League MVP, hit .270, 39 home runs, 114 RBI, still treated with kid gloves by pitchers, 81 walks on the season in 137 games. So it's a no-brainer that this guy deserved to be the comeback player of the year. And of course, he had a burr in his saddle. He had to prove the White Sox and any other naysayers wrong. Well, it helps him out in the offseason heading into 2007, as he is able to sign a much more lucrative contract with the Toronto Blue Jays. Had a full 2007 season, 155 games, a .277 batting average, 26 home runs, 95 RBI for a Blue Jays team that was not very good. And then in 2008, he comes out of the gate slowly. Despite hitting some home runs early on, John Gibbons benches him. He's very, very upset about that. Thomas is. And basically says, hey, you know, I'm not going to deal with this. This is not how my career is going to end. You know, I've come up with some clutch hits here early in the season. I've done some good things here. What the hell? That was basically it. So the Blue Jays just say sayonara. A few days later, the A's come back around, pick him up again. He hits .263 over 55 games and winds down his career right before the end of the 2008 season. And what a career it was. Here's the total numbers. 19 years, 2,322 games, a career batting average of .301, a career OPS of .974, 521 career home runs, 1,704 RBI, 1,667 walks and 2,468 base hits. And if you're a WAR person, a wins after replacement person to justify your Hall of Fame worthiness, a career WAR number of 73.7. So yeah, he was definitely up there. And with just over 83% of the vote in 2014 on his first ballot, inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame, the first member of the Chicago White Sox to do so. And I should throw in there, even though he had a very messy departure from the White Sox, they kissed and made up in 2010. Of course, in 2009, he retired. So in 2009, he no longer played for anybody. But in the winter of 2010, he officially retired, signing a one-day contract with the White Sox. Now, sidebar here, and this is no rip on Frank Thomas, but I absolutely think the whole one-day contract retirement thing is just dumb. Because let's take the Frank Thomas example here. When you think of Frank Thomas, do you think of Frank Thomas of the Oakland A's? No. Do you think Frank Thomas of the Toronto Blue Jays? No. When you say Frank Thomas, you think Chicago White Sox. You think of this picture that's on the front of the 1992 Upper Deck card number 166. So why do you have to go through the formal arrangement of, well, let me sign this one-day contract so I can officially retire as a member of the Chicago White Sox? You're always remembered as a Chicago White Sox player. I mean, come on. And again, this isn't a knock on Frank Thomas. A lot of athletes do it. And I think a lot of teams convince athletes they should do this. I've always wondered, do you actually get paid for signing a one-day contract? Because think about it. You know, Big Hurt was getting $8 million then. I'm not going to be able to do the math here, but one day's work under an old contract had to be a few thousand dollars. Now, if that's the case, then, hey, I'll sign all the one-day contracts you want. But I've always thought that was such a needless addendum to somebody's career. And a lot of other sports have had it. You know, and I think to hockey, of course. Recently, my employer, the Tampa Bay Lightning, they retired Marty St. Louis, jersey number 26. And thankfully, we didn't go through the process of having Marty sign that one-day contract because, you know, the Calgary Flames, who he played with before the Lightning, they're not retiring his number. The New York Rangers, who he demanded a trade to and played after, you know, 14 years with Tampa Bay, they're not going to retire his number. So why go through all that? And, you know, another hockey example, Jaromir Jagr, who's going to outlive us all, by the way, when he retires at the age of 88, he's probably going to play for 62 teams in the NHL. The league will expand that much by then. But you're always going to remember Jaromir Jagr as a member of the Pittsburgh Penguins, even though he played for, you know, he's with the Panthers now. He's played for Dallas and Philadelphia and Boston and the Rangers and the Capitals. I mean, he's been everywhere. You're going to remember him as a Pittsburgh Penguin. I've always thought the whole one-day contract situation was just absolutely nonsense. You know, a player is defined by his time with a particular team, you know, a career, like you look at Frank Thomas, you know, all these years that he played in Major League Baseball, a career that spanned 19 years. Well, of those 19 years, 16 of them were with the White Sox. Is there any confusion which team he's going to be remembered with for the rest of his life? I don't think so. So I've always thought the one-day contract was just a bunch of baloney. Maybe I'm the only one that's off here. I know for some fans it's a sentimental, oh, he's ours forever. Meh, whatever. So anyways, he retired with the White Sox. His number 35 is hanging up in the White Sox stadium, and he graces his presence on the 1992 Upper Deck card number 166. So there you go, the Big Hurt, also known as, I almost forgot that story. I had a former player tell me this. I will not mention this player's name because he was actually kind of embarrassed that he shared the story with me. But Frank Thomas could not hit the inside fastball real well. If you were able to paint the inside corner And high, too. I should say, you know, around belt high, he couldn't hit it. Low ball, he'd take you out of the yard. But some players mockingly called him the big skirt, because as soon as you pounded a fastball inside, he'd kind of clam up and not swing. So that's not very nice, but I just thought I'd pass it on. Anyways, the big hurt, Frank Thomas, Hall of Famer, phenomenal player, doing a lot of broadcasting business now. Also runs a record company, is a CEO of a record company, has a microbrew called Big Hurt Beer. In fact, has a brew pub in the Chicago suburb of Berwyn, Big Hurt's Brew House. So he is still very active in the Chicago community and still living life and living large, as he always has. And still just an amazing story that this guy was undrafted. You know, a multi-sports star in Columbus, Georgia, state champion, should have been a first-round pick in 1986, but got passed by everybody, which is amazing. But again, even though he got passed by, he was still able to cash in with a first-round draft selection in 1989, was able to get a scholarship to Auburn University. Really helped out Auburn. You know, again, Hal Baird was the jackpot winner with that one after, you know, Bo Jackson all of a sudden, oh, here's Frank Thomas. Yeah, we can put him to work. So a great story of perseverance, because a guy like Frank Thomas, he had a chip on his shoulder, and he was able to utilize that to start him in Chicago and beyond, and eventually to the Baseball Hall of Fame. And by all accounts, did it clean. Of course, you know, he had a lot of his best times and some of his biggest recoveries during the steroid era, but he was always up front. Hey, test me if you want to. We should test everybody in baseball. He actually was the only current player to voluntarily speak for the Mitchell Report. So for somebody who there was, of course, suspicions just because of the time, just because of the era and the numbers they put up. But either he was the slyest fox of them all, or he did it clean. And I'm going to lean definitely to the latter. So Big Hurt, Frank Thomas, 1992 Upper Deck, the sham that is one-day contracts, whatever you want to talk about on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, you are more than welcome to, as we look forward to your comments throughout this weekend. And we look forward to our next podcast as we start winding down in 1992. We're going to take a look at Top Stadium Club, the set that bypassed Upper Deck, in my opinion, in many innovations in 1991. Well, they kept it going in 1992, and while Top Stadium Club didn't have to reinvent the wheel in 92, they still put out an outstanding product, and we'll do a random pull from that collection from the Big Old Monster Box on Tuesdays. We come your way on Audio Boom and iTunes. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for checking in with us here at Wax Ecstatic.